He assumed she would seize him in a hug and spin in a pirouette, a mother finding strength in the need to be strong for a beautiful son, a mother finding respite in the love of a beautiful son. She always held him when she was frightened, and she literally reeked with fear. But instead she wheeled him about by the arm and slapped him hard across the cheek. "You are never to say such things!" A tide of murderous hurt and outrage swamped him.
"Mummy! Mummy had struck him! And for what? The truth?"
Scenes flickered beneath his soul's eye, strangling her with her own sheets, seizing the gold mastodon set upon the mantel and—
"But I do!" he bawled. "I do hate him!"
Mathanet, Uncle Holy. She was already holding him in a desperate embrace, shushing and kissing, pressing her tear-slick cheek against his own.
"Mummy."
"You shouldn't," she said, a thumb's breadth from his ear. "He's your uncle. Even more. He's the Shrier. It's a sin to speak against the Shrier. Don't you know that?"
He fought her until she pressed him back.
"But he's against you, against father. Isn't that a s—"
"Enough. Enough. The important thing, Kel, is that you never say these things. You are a prince imperial. An Anasarimber. Your blood is the very blood that flows in your uncle's veins."
"Dunyain blood," the secret voice whispered. "What raises us above the animals?"
"Like mother."
"Do you understand what I'm telling you?"
the Blessed Empress continued. "Do you realize what others think when they hear you disputing your own blood?"
"No. They hear dissension, discord, and weakness. You embolden our enemies with this talk. Do you understand me, Kel?"
"Yes."
"We have come upon fearful times, Kel. Dangerous times. You must always use your wits. You must always be wary—"
"Because of Fanio, Mommy?"
She held him tight to her breast, then pressed him back.
"Because of many things."
Her gaze became suddenly absent.
"Look," she continued. "There's something I need to show you."
She stood and with a rustle of silk moved across the bedchamber, paused before the frieze on the far wall, belts of mythic narrative piled one atop of the other. "Your father raised two palaces when he rebuilt the Endymion Heights," she said, gesturing to the sun slanting through the unshuttered balcony.
"A palace of light?"
She turned, leaning forward on her toes to peer at the top panel of the marble frieze. She pressed the bottommost star of the constellation Kelmomus had never seen before. Something clicked elsewhere in the room. The Prince Imperial literally swayed with vertigo, so surprised were his senses. The marble-gilded wall simply dropped away and swooped out, rotating on a perfect central hinge. Light only filtered several feet into the black passage beyond.
"And a palace of shadow."
"Your uncle,"
Mother said. "I don't trust him." They sat where they always sat when the Empress took her morning sun, as she termed it, on divans set near the heart of the sacral enclosure between the two of the taller sycamore trees. A thin procession of clouds rode high in the blue sky above. The imperial apartments surrounded them on all sides, colonnaded walkways along the ground, verandas on the upper floors, some with their canopies unfurled, all forming the broad marmoreal octagon that gave the enclosure its famous shape. Thalaipa sat immediately next to Mother, a distance that suggested mother-daughter intimacy, but was really an artifact of the girl's blindness to the rules that govern proximity. Her face, as always, was pale and sunken, skin stretched across the tent poles of her bones. She wore what looked like several luxurious gowns, sewn into a florid motley, as well as dozens of jeweled brooches set end to end along the sleeves of either arm. Tree shadows waved across her, so that she seemed continually ablaze with reflected sunlight. Wearing only a morning robe, Mother looked plain and dark in comparison, and all the more beautiful for it.
Kelmomis played in the adjacent garden. With blackened fingers, he started forming walls and bastions, a small complex of dirt structures he could strike down. But it simply stopped when he discovered a stream of ants crawling from the earth to the blue-tiled walkway, hundreds of them. He began executing them, one by one, using his thumbnail to chip off their heads.
What do you suspect?
His sister asked, her voice as dry as the air. A long breath, a hand drawn to the back of her weary neck. That he is somehow behind this crisis with the Yatwarians, his mother replied. That he intends to use it as a pretext to seize the Empire. Of all the games he played, this was the one young Prince Imperial relished the most. The game of securing his mother's constant attention, while at the same time slipping beneath her notice. On the one hand, he was such a sad little boy, desolate, scarred for the tragic loss of his twin. But he was also just a little boy, too young to understand, too lost in his play to really listen. There was a time, not so long ago, when she would have sent him away for conversations such as this. The real ones.
I see, Thalaipa said. Are you not surprised? I'm not sure surprise is a passion I can feel, mother.
Even watching from his periphery, Kelmomis could see his mother's expression dull. It troubled her, the little boy knew, filling in what was missing in her children. Perhaps this is why he didn't despise Thalaipa the way he had that bitch, my Mara. Mother's feelings for Theli would always be stymied by the girl's inability to reciprocate her love. But my Mara.
Someday soon, the secret voice whispered, she will love you as much. More.
Have you conferred with father? Thalaipa asked.
His sister was a face reader. She had to see mother's bewildered heartbreak as easily as he could. Did Theli lack the heart to grieve this as well? Kelmomis had never been able to read much of anything in his sister. She was like Uncle Mathanet that way, only harmless. If mother were ever to look at him with those eyes.
The Far Callers, mother said with the reluctant air of admission.
They've heard nothing for 2 weeks now.
The merest flicker of horror slackened Thalaipa's pale face. Perhaps she could feel surprise after all, as crippled as her heart was.
What?
Do not fear, mother said. Your father lives. The great ordeal continues its march.
I am certain of that much at least. Then what has happened?
Your father has declared an interdiction. He has forbidden every schoolman in the great ordeal, on pain of execution, from contacting any soul in the Three Seas. Kelmomis recalled his lessons on the cants of Far Calling well enough. The primary condition of contacting someone in their dreams was to know precisely where they were sleeping. This meant the great ordeal had to contact them, since it traveled day by day.
He suspects spies among the schools? Thalaipa asked. Is this some kind of ruse to draw them out?
Perhaps.
His sister was generally averse to eye contact, but those rare times she deigned to match someone's gaze, she did so with a peculiar intensity, like a bird spying worms.
You mean father hasn't told you anything?
No.
He abides by his own embargo? Mother, has father deserted us?
The young imperial prince abandoned the pretense of his garden play. He even held his breath, so profound was his hope. For as long as he could remember, Kelmomis had feared and hated his divine father. The warrior prophet, the aspect emperor, the one true Dunyain. All the native abilities possessed by his children, only concentrated and refined through a lifetime of training. Were it not for the demands of his station, were he more than just a constantly arriving and departing shadow, father would have certainly seen the secret Kelmomis had held tight since his infancy, the secret that made him strong. As things stood,
It was only a matter of time. He would grow as his brothers and sisters had grown, and he would drift, as his brothers and sisters had drifted, from mother's loving tutelage to father's harsh discipline. And one day father would peer deep into his eye and see what no one else had seen. And that day, Kel'Momas knew, would be his doom. But what if father had abandoned them? Even better, what if he were dead?
"He has the strength," the voice whispered. "So long as he lives, we are not safe."
Mother raised a finger to scoop tears from either eye. This the young Prince Imperial realized. This was why she had struck him the previous day. This was why the fat fool Pansulla had so easily goaded her, and why the tidings from Shygek had so dismayed her.
"If father is gone," the secret voice dared whisper.
"It would appear so," she said,
speaking about a crack in her voice.
"I fear it has something to do with your uncle."
"Then we are finally safe."
"Maethanet," Theli said. The Empress mastered her feelings with a deep breath. "Maybe this is a test of some kind, like the fable of Gam."
Kel'Momas recalled this from his lessons as well. Gam was a mythical king who faked his own death to test the honor of his four sons. The boy wanted to shout this out, to bask a moment in mother's pride. But he bit his tongue. For the briefest of instants, he thought he saw his sister glance at him.
"It need not have anything to do with uncle," the Lyapa said. "Maybe the consult has discovered some way of eavesdropping on our communications."
"No, it has something to do with Maethanet. I can feel it. I can rarely fathom, father," the Lyapa admitted.
"You," the Empress cried with pained hilarity, "think about your poor mother."
Kel'Momas laughed precisely the way she wanted.
"Ponder it, Theli. Your father assuredly knows about the strife going on between us, his wife and his brother. So then why would he choose this moment to strand us each with the other?"
"That much is simple at least," Theli replied. "Because he believes the best solution will be the one you find on your own."
"Exactly," mother said. "Somehow he thinks my ignorance will serve me in this."
Her voice trailed into pensive thought. For several moments she let her gaze wander across points near and far, within the sacral enclosure, then shook her head in sudden outrage and disgust.
"Damn your father and his machinations!" she cried,
her voice loud enough to draw looks from nearby Polarian guardsmen. She glanced skyward, her eyes rolling with something like panic.
"Damn him!" "Mother?"
the Lyapa asked. The Empress lowered her head and sighed.
"I am quite all right, Theli."
She spared her daughter a rueful look. "I don't give a damn what you think you see in my face." She trailed, her mouth hanging on these words.
Kel'Momas held his breath, so attuned had he become to the wheel of his mother's passion.
"Theli," she began, only to hesitate for several heartbeats. Could you read his face?"
"Uncle's? Only father has that ability. Father and—"
"And who?"
The Lyapa paused as if weighing the wisdom of honest answers.
"Enrilitus. He could see. Remember, father trained him for a time."
"Father trained who?" Kel'Momas cried, the way a jealous little brother might.
"Kel, please. Who?"
Esmenet raised two fingers to Thalaipa, turned to Kel'Momas, her manner cross and adoring.
"Your older brother," she explained. "Your father hoped teaching him to read passions in others would enable him to master his own." She turned back to her daughter.
"Treachery?" she asked. "Could Enrilitus see treachery in a soul so subtle as Maethanet's?"
"Perhaps, mother," the pale girl replied. "But the real question, I think, is not so much can he, as will he?"
The Empress of all the three seas shrugged, her expression betraying the fears that continually mobbed her heart. I need to know. What do we have to lose? Since Mother had to attend special sessions with her generals, the young Prince Imperial dined alone that evening, or as alone as possible for a soul such as his. He was outraged even though he understood her reasons, and as always he tormented the slaves who waited on him, blaming his mother for each and every hurt he inflicted. Later that night he pulled the board from beneath his bed and resumed working on his model. Since his uncle's treachery had loomed so large that day, he decided to work on the Temple Zothe, the monumental heart of the Chimeral Temple complex. He began cutting and paring miniature columns, using the little knives that Mother had given him in lieu of a completed model.
"What a man makes," she had told him, "he prizes."
Unerringly, without the benefit of any measure, he carved them, not only one identical to the other, but in perfect proportion to those structures he had already completed. He never showed his work to Mother. It would trouble her, he knew. His ability to see places just once, and from angles buried within them, yet to grasp them the way a bird might from far above. The way Father grasped the world. But even worse, if he showed his little city to her, it would complicate the day when he finally burned it. She did not like the way he burned things. Bugs, he thought. He needed to fill the streets of his little city with bugs. Nothing really burned, he decided, unless it moved. He thought of the ants in the garden. He thought of the Polarian guardsmen patrolling the sacral enclosure. He could even hear their voices in the evening breeze as they whiled away the watches with fatuous talk. He thought about the fun he could have, sneaking about them, more shadow than little boy. He thought about his previous murders, and the mysterious person he saw trapped in the eyes of the dying. The one person he loved more than his mother, the one and only. Convulsing, bewildered, terrified, and beseeching most of all.
"Please, please don't kill me."
"The worshipper," he declared aloud. "Yes," the secret voice whispered. "That's a good name."
"A most strange person, don't you think, Sammy?"
"Most strange."
"The worshipper," Kelmomus said, testing the sound. "How can he travel like that from body to body?"
"Perhaps he's locked in a room. Perhaps dying is that room's only door."
"Locked in a room," the young Prince Imperial cried, laughing. "Yes, clever, clever, cunning clever."
And so he slipped into the gloomy hallways, dodging and ducking and scampering. Only the merest shiver in the shining lantern flames marked his passing. Finally, he arrived at the door. The high bronze one with 7 Kyrenian lions stamped into its greening panels, their manes bent into falcon wings. The one his mother had forbidden the slaves to polish until the day it could be safely opened. The door to his brother Enrelatus' room. It stood partially ajar. Kelmomus had expected, even hoped, to find it such. The slaves who attended to his brother generally did so, whenever lulls in his tantrums permitted. During his brother's calm seasons, however, they followed an exact schedule, cleansing and feeding Arilitus, the watch before noon and the watch before midnight. The boy mooned in the corridor for several moments, alternately staring at the stylized dragons stitched in crimson, black, and gold across the corridor's carpet, and stealing what glimpses the narrow slot provided of the cell's bare floor interior. Eventually, his curiosity mastered his fear. Only Father terrified him more than Enrelatus, and he pressed his face to the opening, peering past the belt of brushed leather that had been tacked to the door's outer rim to better seal in the sound and smell of his mad brother. He could see an attendant to his left, a harried-looking Nilnameshi man soaping the walls and floor with a rake mop. He saw his brother sitting hunched like a shaved ape to the right of the room, his edges illuminated in the light of a single brazier. Each of his limbs were shackled to a chain that ran like an elongated tongue from the mouth of a stone lion head, one of four set into the far wall, two with their manes pressed against the ceiling, two with their chins across the floor. A winch room lay beyond that wall, Kelmomus knew, with wheels and locks for each of the chains, allowing the attendants to pull his brother spread-eagled against the polished stone, if need be, or to grant him varying degrees of freedom otherwise. From the look of the links curled across the floor, they had afforded him two lengths or so of mobility, enough to both relieve and embolden the boy. Enrilatus usually howled and raged without some modicum of slack. At first, Kelmomus thought him absolutely motionless. But he was not. He sat making faces. Expressions. Not many faces, but those belonging to the slave who bent to and fro with his mop, a mere toss away, scrubbing away urine and feces with a perfumed astringent. Periodically the deaf-mute would cast a terrified glance in his prisoner's direction, only to see his face reflected back to him.
"Most of them flee," Enrilatus said.
Kelmomus knew he addressed him, even though he did not so much as glance at the boy.
"Sooner or later, they choose the whip over my gaze."
"They are simple fools,"
Kelmomus replied, too timid to press open the door, let alone cross the threshold.
"They are exactly what they appear to be."
The shaggy mane turned. Enrilatus fixed the young Prince Imperial with wild and laughing blue eyes. "Unlike you, little brother." Save for his long face, Enrilatus looked utterly unlike the brother Kelmomus remembered from his infancy. His growth had come, gilding his naked form in a golden haze of hair, and years of warring against his iron restraints had strapped his frame in luxurious muscle. A beard stubbled his chin and the line of his jaw, but had yet to climb his cheeks. His voice was deep and beguiling, not unlike father's.
"Come, little brother," Enrilatus said with a comradely grin.
He leapt toward the entrance so suddenly that the deaf-mute fumbled the handle of his mop and tripped backward. He landed at a point just shy of where the chains would bring him up short. Kelmomus watched his brother squat and defecate, then retreat to his previous position. Still smiling, Enrilatus waved his little brother forward. He possessed a man's wrists now, the hands of a thick-fingered warrior.
"Come, I want to discuss the shit between us."
With anyone else, Kelmomus would have thought this a mad joke of some kind. Not so with Enrilatus. The boy pressed the door inward, strode into the stench, pausing but two steps from the coiled feces. The slave glimpsed Kelmomus in his periphery, wheeled in sudden alarm, but the man was quick to resume his cleaning when he recognized him. Like so many palace slaves, terror kept him welded to the task before him.
"You show no revulsion," Enrilatus said, nodding at the feces.
Kelmomus did not know what to say, so he said nothing.
"You're not like the others, are you, little brother? No, you are like me."
"Remember your face," the secret voice warned. "Only father possesses the strength in greater measure."
"I am nothing like you," the little Prince Imperial replied. It seemed strange, standing on the far side of the door. And wrong, so very wrong.
"But you are," Enrilatus chuckled. "All of us inherited our father's faculties in some mangled measure. Me? I possess his sensitivities, but I utterly lack his unity, his control. My natures blow through me. Hungers. Glorious hungers. Unfettered by little armies of shame that hold the souls of others in absolute captivity. Father's reason mystifies me. Mother's compassion makes me howl with laughter. I am the world's only unbound soul. He raised his shackled wrists as he said this, gestured to the polluted floor before him. I shit when I shit. A ringing filled the boy's ears. Such was the intensity of his older brother's gaze. He began to speak, but his voice caught, as though about a hook in his throat. Enrilatus grinned. What about you, little brother? Do you shit when you shit?
He sees me, the secret voice whispered. You have become reckless in father's abs.
Who? Enrilatus laughed. The shadow of hearing moves through you, as it so often does when no one is speaking?
Who whispers to you, little brother?
Mommy says you're mad.
Ignore the question, his older brother snapped. State something insulting, something that will preoccupy and thus evade a prickly question.
Come closer, little brother. Come closer and tell me you do not shit when you shit.
I don't understand what you mean.
He knows you lie.
Of course you know. Come closer. Let me peer into your mouth. Let me listen to this whisper that is not your voice.
Who? Who speaks inside of you?
Kelmomus fell backward a step. Enrilatus had managed to creep forward somehow, to steal slack from his chains without the boy noticing.
Uncle is coming to see you.
A heartbeat of appraising silence. Again you ignore the question. But this time you state a truth. One that you know will intrigue me. You mean Uncle Holy, don't you? Uncle Holy is coming to visit me? I smell mother in that.
The boy found strength in her mere mention.
Yes, mother wants you to read his face. She fears that he plots against father, against us. She thinks only you can see.
Come closer.
But Uncle has learned how to fool you.
Even as he spoke the words, Kelmomus cursed them for their clumsiness. This was an Anasarimber crouched before him. Divinity. Divinity burned in Enrilatus's blood as surely as in his own.
Kin! Enrilatus crowed. Blood of my blood! What love you possess for mother. I see it burn. Burn! Until all else is char and ash. Is she the grudge you bear against Uncle?
But Kelmomus could think of nothing else to say or do.
To answer any of his brother's questions, he knew, was to wander into labyrinths he could not hope to solve.
He had to press forward.
He has learned to disguise his disgust as pity, Uncle Holy, his treachery as concern.
There was no other way through the monstrous intellect before him.
This is a mistake.
The whisper warns you, Enrilatus laughed, his eyes bright, not for the twin flames they reflected, but something more incendiary still.
Apprehension.
You do not like sharing. Such a peevish... devious little soul. Come closer, little brother.
He sees me.
You cannot let him fool you, the boy cried, trying to goad a pride that did not exist.
I see him. The one you hide. Oh, yes. The other one.
The whisperer. I see him,
Enrilatus crooned.
What does he tell you? Is he the one who wants Uncle Holy dead?
You will want to kill him, brother, when he comes. I can help you.
More laughter, warm and avuncular, at once teasing, and protective.
"And now you offer the beast candy. Come closer, little brother. I want to stare into your mouth."
"You will want to kill Uncle Holy," Calmomus repeated, his thoughts giddy with sudden inspiration. "Think, brother, the sum of sins!"
And with that single phrase, the young Prince Imperial's dog persistence was rescued. Or so he thought. Where his brother had fairly radiated predatory omniscience before, his manner suddenly collapsed inward. Even his nakedness, which had been that of the rapist, lewd, virile, bestial, lapsed into its chill, invulnerable contrary. He actually seemed to shrink in his chains. Suddenly, Enrilatus seemed as pathetic as the human shit breathing on the floor between them. The young man's eyes flinched from the boy's gaze, sought melancholy reprieve in the shadowy corners of his cell's ceiling.
"Do you ever wonder, Kel, why it is I do what I do?"
"No," the boy answered honestly.
Enrilatus glanced at his brother, then down to the floor. Breathing deep, he smiled the sad smile of someone lost in a game, pursued too far for too long. Too long to abandon. Too long to continue.
"I do it to heap damnation upon myself," he said, as if making an absurd admission.
"But why?" the boy asked, genuinely curious now.
"Be wary," the secret voice whispered. "Because I can think of no greater madness."
And what greater madness could there be, exchanging a handful of glorious heartbeats for an eternity of anguish and torment? But the boy shied from this question.
I don't understand," he said. "You could leave this room any time you wished. Mother would release you, I know it. You just need to follow the rules."
His brother paused, looked at him as if searching for evidence of kinship beyond the fact of their blood.
"Tell me, little brother, what rules the rule?" "Something is wrong," the voice warned.
"The god?" the boy said, shrugging.
"And what rules the god?"
"Nothing. No one."
"He breathes as you breathe," the secret voice whispered. "Blinks as you blink. Even his heartbeat captures your own. He draws your unthinking soul into the rhythms of his making. He mesmerizes you."
Enrilatus nodded in solemn affirmation. "So the god is unconstrained?"
"Yes."
Enrilatus stood with sudden grace, walked to the limit of his chains. He seemed godlike in the gloom, his hair falling in flaxen sheets about his shoulders, his limbs bound in veined muscle, his phallus laying long and violet in a haze of golden down. He placed his foot upon his feces, and using his toes, smeared it in a foul arc across the floor below him.
"So the god is like me!"
And just like that, the boy understood. The senseless sense of his brother's acts, the miraculous stakes of his mad exchange. Suddenly this little room, the shit-stained prison cell hidden from the light of shame, seemed a holy place, a temple to a different revelation, the nail of a darker heaven.
"Yes," the boy murmured, lost in the wisdom, the heartbreaking wisdom, of his brother's constant gaze.
And it seemed his brother's voice soaked into the surrounding walls, cupped everything that could be seen. "The god punishes us according to the degree we resemble him." Enrilatus towered before him.
"And you resemble him, little brother. You resemble..." What was this trap he had set for him? How could understanding, insight, capture?
"No," the boy cried. "I am not mad. I am not like you."
Laughter, warm and gentle, so like mother when she is lazy and wishes only to tease and cuddle her beautiful little son.
"Look,"
Anassarimber Enrilitus commanded. Look at this heap of screams you call the world, and tell me you would not add to them, pile them to the sky.
He has the strength, the secret voice whispered.
I would, Anassarimber Kel'Momas admitted. I would.
His limbs trembled. His heart hung as if plummeting through a void. What was this crashing within him? What was this release?
The truth.
And his brother's voice resonated, climbed as if communicating up out of his bones. You think you seek the love of our mother, little brother? Little knife? You think you murder in her name, but that love is simply cloth, thrown over the invisible. What you use to reveal the shape of something so much greater. Memories tumbled into his soul's eye. Memories of his whelming. How he had followed the beetle to the feet of the grinning god. The four-horned brother. How they had laughed when he had maimed the bug. Laughed together. Memories of the Yatwarian priestess. How she had shrieked blood while the mother of fertility stood helpless. And the boy could feel it. An assumption of glory. A taking possession of a certainty that had possessed him all along. Possessed him in ignorance. Yes. Godhead.
Come closer,
Enrilitus said in a whisper that seemed to boom across all creation. He nodded to the arc smeared across the floor between them. Wander across the line others have etched for you. The young Prince Imperial watched his left foot, small and white and bare, step forward. But a gnarled hand caught him, held him with gentle insistence. Somehow the deaf-mute attendant had circled around without the boy noticing. The man wagged his face in alarm and horror. Enrilitus began laughing. "Flee, little brother," he said, passion fluting through his voice. "I can feel the—" He dandled his tongue on his lips as if savoring his own sweetness. Even his eyes widened in animal fury. A coital shudder passed through him. "I feel the rage!" he roared to the stone bolts. "The Furies!" He seized the slack chains, wrenched them savagely enough to make the links screech for biting one another. Saliva swung from his mouth when he jerked his face back to Kel'Momas. "I can feel it come. Come upon me." His phallus climbed into a grinning arc. "Divinity!" The boy stood astounded. At last he yielded to the attendant and his shoulder-tugging hands. Allowed the wretch to pull him from his brother's cell. He knew Enrilitus would find the little gift he had left for him, lying along the seam between the floor stones. The small phial he had stolen from the palace tinker. Not so long ago. Iothea. Fire, fierce enough to sting the skin from paces away. Smoke. Rolling in oily sheets, acrid enough to prick the eyes, needle the throat. Screams, violent enough to cramp the heart. Screams. Too many screams. Dizzy and nauseated, Malawabi rode close beside Faniel Ab Kaskamandri, as the Padaraja toured the streets, some raucous, others abandoned. The second negotiant had never witnessed the sacking of a village, let alone a city as vast and mighty as Iothea. It reminded him that High Holy Zeum, for all its high holy bluster, knew very little about war. The men of the three seas, he had come to realize, warred without mercy or honor. Where the dynastic skirmishes his Zeumi kinsmen called war were bound by ancient code and custom, Faniel and his men recognized no constraints that he could see, save that of military expediency and exhaustion. They fought the way Shrank fought. The Bimayu sorcerer saw entire streets carpeted in bodies. He saw several rapes, the victims either vacant or shrieking, and more summary executions than he cared to count. He saw a pale-skinned columnary holding a squalling baby in one arm while trying to battle two laughing kyanine in the other. He saw an old man jumping from a rooftop, his clothing afire. Perhaps glimpsing something of his dismay, Fanile was at pains to describe the atrocities suffered by his own people during the First Holy War and the subsequent wars of unification. A kind of madness warbled through his outrage as he spoke, condemnation spoken in the tones of divine revelation, as if nothing could be more right and true than the slaughter and the rapine about them. The bloodthirsty excuse, the sage Mengawa had called it. Retribution. But there is more to this than crude vengeance, Fanile explained, as if suddenly recalling the learning of the man he addressed. The Padaraja was proud of his own youthful education, Malawabi knew, but found the posture difficult to recover after decades of brutality and fugitive insurrection. "You make an example of the first," the man continued. "Then you show mercy to the second. First you teach them to fear you, then you earn their trust. Nirsi Sheltatra, we call it. The honey and the goad." Malawabi could not but reflect on how easily the whip and the honey became confused. Everywhere they rode, the Kayanin turned from their sordid labors and called out to their lord in exultation and gratitude, cheered as if famished guests at a sumptuous feast. "Savages, cousin, you have sent me out among savages." Something. Malawabi's silence, perhaps, convinced the bandit Padaraja to cut their tour short. They reversed direction, rode for what seemed an entire watch, plagued by the sound of a babe crying. Malawabi could almost believe someone followed them, torturing a cat. Silence haunted the empty windows. Smoke sheeted the west in gauze rags, lending an eerie, watery timbre to the sunlight that slanted across the dying city. Finally they returned to the rack and ruin of the city's northwestern walls, the section brought down by Mepa. Once again Malawabi found himself gawking. "It frightens, you know," Fanile said, watching his profile. "The spilling of the water?"
"What do you mean?"
The Padaraja graced him with an upside-down smile. "I've been told that schoolmen find the Kishauram Suke troubling. You see a violation with your mundane eyes, the glare of sorcery, when your other eye, the one that itches, sees only mundane creation." Malawabi shrugged, thinking of the brief duel between Mepa and the lone Sake sorcerer, the decrepit and disheveled old man who had defended the hapless city, the rogue Kishauram floating, impervious to the fire of the schoolman's anagogic dragon head, disgorging cataracts of blue, twinkling light, as pure as it was beautiful. As awesome as Mepa's power had been, there was no doubting he was a primary. It had been the beauty that had most astounded and mortified the second negotiant. To be a sorcerer was to dwell among deformities. "It is extraordinary," Malawabi admitted, "to see the work without the mark." He smiled the wise and slippery smile of an old diplomat. "But we schoolmen are accustomed to miracles." He said this last more in bitter jest than anything. What he witnessed had left many profound impressions. The power of Mepa, certainly. The martial acumen of the Padaraja. The cunning and bravery of the Fainim. Not to mention their barbarity. But nothing looms so large as the weakness of the new empire. The rumors were absolutely true. The Aspect Emperor had boned his conquests to pursue his mad invasion of the northern wilds. Disaffected populations, ill-equipped soldiers, poorly trained and even more poorly led, infirm and doddering schoolmen, And most interestingly, absolutely no Kore. Ngunka, nay, Zeum, needed to be informed. This night would be filled with far-calling dreams. The people call him Stonebreaker, Fanile said. Mepa, they say he was sent to us by the solitary god. Malawabi turned to him, blinking. What do you say? I say he was sent to me, the hawk-faced Padaraja cried, laughing. I am the solitary god's gift to his people. And what does he say? The second negotiant asked, now genuinely curious. Mepa? He does not know who he is,